Hello, Almighty All. Today I'll be speaking about message passing programs, in particular reactors, and about 8 different ways to handle non-blocking returns in them. In addition, I'll try to make a very brief overview of existing proposals under consideration by C++ committee, also known as WG21, and we'll try to demonstrate how do they fit into our non-blocking returns. That's a lot of stuff, and to fit into a lot of time, it has to be a very intensive session. My apologies if anything looks too sketchy. In the end, I will try to provide a few pointers where further information can be found. Before we can really start with the talk, I'd like to make an important announcement. I have to confess that this is not really my presentation. Rather, it is a talk by this guy. And you can also see him on my t-shirt too. It means that if there is anything good with this presentation, it should be attributed to me. And if there is anything bad, it is all his fault. By the way, if you think that my accent is bad, you should be grateful that it is not him speaking. I can assure you that his accent is much worse than mine. As you may guess, it is quite difficult to produce human sounds for a rabbit. Preliminary aside, we can proceed with the substance of the talk. In part zero of the talk, well, as we are in C++ land, we have to start everything with zero, I'll try to define what is the task we are going to solve. First, we will have an extremely brief overview of message passing and reactors, including their benefits. And then we will include non-blocking processing, which is very closely related to interactions between main processing and return processing. In particular, I will mention that depending on whether we want to process intervening events while waiting for the result of our outstanding call, non-blocking processing can be simpler than blocking one. There is no one single definition of message passing, but to convey the idea, I think that it is the best to use the following adage from effective Go. Do not communicate by sharing memory, instead share memory by communicating. While this wording doesn't come from C++ land, it does convey the concept, which is more or less equivalent to shared nothing. In practice, it means three things. First, all the processing within business logic is confined to one single thread, or at least as if it is one single thread. Second, there is no memory sharing, which in turn means that all the mutexes are gone. Last but not least, we should have a way to pass messages between different threads, processes, or even different computers. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into detailed discussions on the benefits of message passing, so I will just list them here, highlighting the most interesting ones. Most importantly, message passing allows to avoid cognitive overload, which arises whenever we are trying to deal both with business logic and with thread synchronization at the same time. This, in turn, simplifies programming greatly. Second, with message passing, it is easy to make our programs deterministic, which in turn enables such goodies as production post-mortem debugging. Yes, it is used in practice. And replay-based regression testing. And when it comes to concurrency, scalability, and performance, message passing architectures tend to beat mutex-based ones too. In particular, due to zero contention and due to avoiding expensive thread context switches, and context switch can cost up to a million CPU clock cycles, if we account for caching validation. Another performance-related consideration is that message passing programs tend to have much better spatial locality. And overall, from scalability point of view, message passing architectures are shared nothing. And shared nothing architectures rules forever. There are many different ways to implement message passing. However, to be specific for this talk, I'll concentrate on one single incarnation of message passing, the one which I prefer to call reactors. Reactors are historically known under different names: actors, reactors, event-driven programs, and ad hoc finite state machines. They are widely used in very different programming environments, from GUI to HPC with game development in between, and are supported by different programming languages and frameworks, starting from Windows Messages and all the way to Node.js. Now it certainly looks as a good time for C++ to start supporting event-driven programs as first-class citizens too. Most important for us, however, is that while from now on we'll be speaking only about reactors, most of our findings are generalizable to more generic message passing. One exception is related to allocator-related serialization. While it does work for reactors, at the moment I don't know how to generalize it to all the message passing programs. As we'll be speaking in terms of reactors quite a bit, let's establish some basic terminology which we'll use. Let's name a common denominator for all our reactors, a generic reactor. As we can see, it is an almost empty class with abstract class with only one pure virtual function react. There are different interpretations available. We will stick to this one. Let's name infrastructure code a code which calls our reactor React. Pretty often, though not strictly required, it happens inside so-called event loop shown on the slide. As we can see, everything happens in one single thread. So there is no need to have any kind of thread synchronization within a reactor React. As for a get event function, it can get events from pretty much anything, starting from select, poll, epoll, kq on the server side, or using libraries such as libuv on the client side. I have to note that event loop is not the only way we can use our reactors. In particular, it is perfectly possible to have thread pools calling reactors as long as we are synchronizing on the reactor before going into reactor React. But in any case, what is really important is that we are avoiding all kinds of thread synchronizations within our reactor React. And finally, let's name any specific derivative from our generic reactor, a specific reactor. It is the place where all our business logic will be implemented. One further thing to note is that virtual function-based implementation is certainly not the only one possible for reactors, and that we can achieve pretty much the same result but using templates. This one is just simple to demonstrate. After we defined our landscape, let's see what is the specific problem I'm trying to discuss today. It is a problem of non-blocking processing. Non-blocking code has a pretty bad reputation among developers. In particular, it is perceived to be significantly more complicated than equivalent blocking code. As we'll see a bit later, in part it can be attributed to the lack of adequate support for non-blocking processing in the programming languages. But in addition, there is a little bit of confusion about the context of non-blocking processing. In practice, it happens that we have to distinguish two very different scenarios. The first scenario, arises when we do not need to process anything while waiting for the result of our outstanding call. In this case, if going for non-blocking processing, we'll be doing it only for performance reasons. And indeed, in this case, code complexity of non-blocking code will increase compared to the blocking code. The second scenario occurs when we do need to process intervening events while waiting for the result of our outstanding operation. Examples of such situations are numerous. As one all-important example, for an interactive program, refusing to process inputs while waiting for a result of outstanding over the internet operation will result in effectively hanged program, which is pretty much suicidal. And if we will look at this second scenario from the point of view of code complexity, we will see that while non-blocking code can be ugly, blocking code to implement the same interaction between processing of return from our non-blocking call, from our outstanding call, and main processing, we need to resort to thread synchronization, which happens to be much worse than non-blocking code. In particular, I'm of a very strong opinion that combining of business logic with thread synchronization in the same piece of code almost inevitably leads to cognitive overload, exceeding that magic number of 7 plus minus 2 entities which we can deal with simultaneously. This in turn means that reasoning about blocking code which processes intervening events inevitably becomes extremely difficult. This dual nature of complexity with relation to non-blocking processing leads us to the concept of mostly non-blocking processing, where we'll use non-blocking processing only if there is a chance that we do need to process intervening events while we are waiting for the results of our outstanding call. On the other hand, under mostly non-blocking processing, we may block as long as the outstanding operation is short enough, so we can postpone processing until of the intervening events until we have the result. One such example includes accessing local disk or local database. For most of real-world scenarios, we can say that if this takes too long, we should be already speaking about fault recovery and not about non-blocking processing. Unfortunately, we don't have time to elaborate on mostly non-blocking processing. What is mostly important for us now is that mostly non-blocking processing or otherwise, we are mostly interested in interactions between main control flow and processing of returned values. Let me repeat it once again. It is all about interactions. Pretty much nothing else. Now we can get to the real stuff. In part one of the talk, we'll define the holy grail of our non-blocking processing. In general, we'd want our non-blocking processing to be as close to the blocking one as possible, but there is a significant caveat related to those interactions which I mentioned just a few seconds ago. Then we'll proceed to taking a quick look at 8 different ways of handling non-blocking returns, one by one. Of course, given our time restrictions, detailed analysis is not possible. But as promised before, I will provide pointers to a more detailed discussion at the end of the talk. To compare different ways of handling non-blocking returns, we'll take one simple closed real-world example, and we'll see how our 8 different approaches will handle it. The idea of the processing which will use as a litmus test for our different ways of non-blocking processing is shown on the diagram. We have a game and a player who wants to purchase something to be used in the game. Player tells what he wants to purchase to the client, then client sends a request to our cashier reactor, then cashier reactor sends a database request to database reactor. On receiving reply, there are two possible cases. If transactions has failed for whatever reason, we return error back to the client, but if purchase was successful, we have to issue another request to game world reactor so that item becomes available in the game world. On receiving reply back from the game world, we send okay reply back to the client. By the standards of distributed systems, it qualifies as a very, very simple use case, but as we'll see, it is sufficient to demonstrate the differences in non-blocking processing. Let's take a look at the blocking code which implements the logic on the diagram on the previous slide. While it is clear that non-blocking code cannot be really that as simple as blocking code, we should at least try to have it as close as possible. In this blocking version, everything looks very simple. There is a very modest amount of boilerplate code, and the essence of our interactions is very clear. First, we are making a blocking RPC call to our database reactor. And then, depending on the result of the first call, we may issue another blocking RPC call to our game world reactor. That's pretty much it. Let's also note that for this type of code, we have to assume that we do have some kind of interface definition language, IDL, and an IDL compiler which generates stubs and skeletons for these blocking RPC functions. When the bright future described by Herb Sutter in his talk on Wens dematerializes, we will be able to have in-language IDL, but at this time we are not there yet. We will also assume that our IDL compiler is sufficiently universal or written by ourselves, which is certainly not rocket science, and that it will be able to generate anything we need, not only for this blocking processing, but also for all our eight variations of non-blocking processing, which we'll see later. When looking at our blocking code, we have to note that for non-blocking purposes, blocking code we have seen is not exactly ideal. In particular, as our non-blocking code is all about allowing interactions with our reactor state, while the call is outstanding, it means the state of our reactor can change while we are within the call. As a result, the code on the slide may occasionally fail. Compared to the previous slide, all we did is just adding those two highlighted lines. And while in blocking code they are perfectly fine, in non-blocking code this assertion may fail. Indeed, while we are waiting for the result of DBO purchase item to arrive back, there may have been an intervening event which may have caused changes within our cashier reactor object. To allow developers to know when such implicit updates can possibly happen, it is necessary at least to make it clear where exactly those points where the state can be implicitly modified can potentially occur. On the slide, those points are marked with a re-entry marker for function calls. There is no special meaning for re-entry here. It is merely intended to illustrate some kind of marker. As we will see, equivalent markers will look very, very differently depending on the technology, specific technology we are using. However, my current point is that we have to have some kind of indication for those points where the state can change. With this in mind, my current point of view is that this code on the slide is the best one we can actually get for our non-blocking code. At the very least, I haven't seen anything better. As such, I will consider it as a holy grail non-blocking implementation for our example scenario of item purchase. And we'll use this holy grail code as a baseline for comparison for all our 8 non-blocking takes. Historically, first non-blocking implementation were based on plain messages. Such an implementation for our item purchase example is shown on the slide. Yes, it is this bad. Let's take a bit closer look at it. First, we need to create a struct to store the context of our request so we can handle return properly. There is nothing really meaningful here, but we still have to write this boilerplate code. Nothing interesting. Then we have to have a map to request request IDs to this struct which stores the context. Again, there is not much meaningful here. I should mention that while in some cases it is possible to say, for example, that there is only one outstanding request per type, in general, it is usually better to avoid this kind of things as they have a tendency to become unmanageable very quickly. The same stands for ad hoc tricks, which allow to identify replies by embedding additional information into reply instead of request ID. As we got our initial request from the client, we need to save the context into the struct, compose the message using a function provided by our IDL compiler, send the message, and save our struct into the map. By the way, in addition to being extremely verbose, this code is also very error-prone. This kind of code is not only ugly, but it's pretty easy to make a mistake when typing it in. Then, on receiving a reply from our DB reactor, we need to find the request in the map and check its status. Now, just for a change, we have one line of non-boilerplate meaningful code, the one which was present in our non-blocking version. But, as you have already guessed, it is followed by even more boilerplate. Overall, amount of boilerplate code in take one is enormous. Out of over 70 lines of code in our take one, only about 10 are meaningful. It becomes especially obvious when we place take one code and holy grail code side by side. This slide pretty much summarizes the problems with take one. Amount of boilerplate code is so large that all the business logic is completely buried in it. What's interesting, though, is that I've seen perfectly working systems based on this kind of non-blocking handling, though their maintenance costs was a completely different story. For our take two, we will consider a technique which is quite popular in game development today, and is based on non-blocking void-only RPC calls. The idea behind using void and non-throwing RPC calls is that as there is no reply whatsoever, it means that we don't need to answer a question what to do when the reply arrives. On the other hand, such void-only RPC calls provide only very marginal improvement over plain messages. In particular, to implement a typical request-response example, we have to use two void-only RPC calls, one to send request and another to send reply back. As a result, most of the boilerplate code from take one is still present in take two. We still have to use request context struct, map of request IDs into these structs, as well as we have fill the context on sending request and find it on receiving reply, and all the options, all the opportunities to get things wrong are still already here. Overall, improvements in readability of take two compared to take one are not as large as we'd like them to be. While 50 lines of code is indeed better than 70, it is still 5 times more than in our Holy Grail code. Our take three is about object-oriented callbacks. It is a thing which I was doing myself about 20 years ago when architecting a pretty large reactor-based system. The architecture is still in use pretty much without changes, and it does work. As we can see from slightly increased font size, take three is just a bit less verbose than take two. With take three, it is all about callback objects. And it takes lots of boilerplate to describe them. We need a callback object to handle return from our non-blocking request to the database. And again, there is nothing really meaningful here. It's just boilerplate. And another callback object for the non-blocking call to our game world. And only after we are done with describing those callback objects and are over 50% down our take three code, we get to somewhat meaningful stuff. It is still has lots of boilerplate, but at least it is interspersed with something meaningful. Currently highlighted in the code is processing of our original purchase request from the client. And here's the return handler. One thing which we can notice about take three is that there is no longer explicit handling of the request ID to callback mapping in this code. While these maps are still present behind the scenes, we managed to hide them from the view of application level developer, which is actually a big relief. If we compare our take three to our baseline Holy Grail code, we'll see that take three, while being less verbose than take two, still has like 4 times more lines of code than Holy Grail one. On the plus side, however, in addition to being less error prone than takes one and two, we can see that meaningful code is concentrated in a smaller portion of the our take three, which improves its readability. Overall, take three, while being verbose, has been observed to be perfectly usable and perfectly working. I would even go as far as saying that it is the best thing we could do before the advent of C++ 11. And most importantly, before lambdas. Up to now, all our takes were doable even in C++ 98. Now let's see how we can improve it with the power provided by C++ 11. Our take four is all about lambdas, more lambdas, and even more lambdas, leading us to an infamous lambda pyramid. We can immediately see that amount of boilerplate has reduced drastically. Actually, it is the first time when the code at least is at least somewhat readable on one single slide. Ideologically, in the code in our take 4 is actually very similar to the code in to the object-oriented callbacks in take 3. It is just that instead of those verbose object-oriented callbacks, we are using lambda closures conveniently generated for us by the compiler behind the scenes. Here are our lambdas. One important point about C++ and lambdas is that while we are using lambda capture by copy, it still captures current object, the one referred to by this pointer, by reference. Accidentally, this is exactly the behavior which we want to have for our purposes. We do want to capture stack variables by value, so they survive when we exit from our cache purchase item function. But at the same time, we do want to capture our reactor object by reference so we can access its current state when processing our non-blocking return. If we compare take 4 to our holy grail code, we'll see that verbosity-wise, they're about the same. However, readability-wise, take 4 is still far from perfect. And it will become even more obvious if we introduce exception handling. Most importantly, the code which is logically linear on the right side becomes nested within our take 4 code. This, as well as counterintuitive indents for the logically linear code, is what earned take 4 the name lambda pyramid. As soon as the number of non-blocking operations in original linear code goes to 4-5, the whole thing becomes quite poorly readable. Let's see how we can improve it further. Our take 5 is about so-called futures. Very, very briefly, the idea is to create a placeholder known as future, where the result of certain operation which will only become known in the future can be stored. And as soon as we have those future objects, we can specify actions which have to be done as soon as the result within the future becomes known. These actions are often referred to as continuations. If we compare our take 5 to our baseline holy grail code, we will see that verbosity of futures is still in check. But unlike lambda pyramids, the code which is linear on the right is still linear on the left. I'd certainly say that take 5 is the best we've discussed so far. By the way, as an added benefit, concepts such as we need to wait for two RPC calls to complete are easily expressible with futures too. Last but not least about our take 5, let's note that in spite of being conceptually similar to STD future, our reactor futures are not identical to it. Most importantly, STD future, at least as of now, is mostly about thread synchronization. And our reactor futures, they operate within the context of one single thread and actually are all about continuations. As a result, reactor futures are more similar to folly future, though it seems that future futures from STD experimental will implement continuations and can be used for this purpose. If we extend the idea of futures even further, we can get to constructing the whole code trees from lambdas. The value of such approach becomes obvious as soon as we realize that not all the code is linear. And that there are conditions and exceptions. As we are very limited on time today, I won't give an example with conditions, but here is an example comparing our holy grail code with exceptions added, so it's inherently more complicated than previous Holy Grail code. We'll compare it to the code builder approach in TX6. The idea behind code builder is that we are effectively building a code tree in runtime. And as soon as this code tree is built, we can then our infrastructure code can run it in a perfectly asynchronous manner. Most importantly, for our current purposes, is that elements of our code tree directly correspond to the elements of our original Holy Grail code on the right. Whenever we have try on the right side, we have a corresponding t-try on the left. Whenever we have linear code on the right, we have more or less equivalently looking code on the left, and so on. And even if we have loops with non-blocking calls within, which are pretty difficult to handle, we will still have a one-to-one correspondence between blocking code and non-blocking one, and with exactly the same nesting too. Overall, TX6, while being admittedly more verbose than TX5, is much more flexible than that. And before the advent of Core Await, it could be a good choice for more complicated use cases. By the way, if we introduce preprocessor into the picture, we are able to reduce verbosity of TX6 significantly while preserving all its good properties. Whether improved readability is worth the trouble of debugging code with heavy preprocessor macros is an open question, but such a possibility does exist. Our TX7, well, we are getting close to the end, will be about stackful coroutines and or fibers. Fortunately for us, we don't have to go into a lengthy discussion about the differences between the two. For us, it's sufficient to say that fibers and stackful coroutines are pretty much the same for our purposes. In non-exactly standard, but still widely cross-platform C++, stackful coroutines are represented by boost coroutines. So personally, I'd prefer to my ideal compiler to use boost context directly. As we can see, the code in our TX7 on the first glance looks better than that of TX6 and TX6A. However, it comes at the cost of two important caveats. First, with stackful fiber coroutines, it becomes very difficult to serialize the state of our reactor. And to achieve quite a few all important properties of reactors, including such beauties as post-mortem debugging and low latency fault tolerance, it is necessary to serialize reactor state. Granted, in C++, serialization is not a picnic even with lambdas, but with stackful coroutines, I don't even know how we can approach this task. By the way, if somebody in audience knows, I would be very interested in hearing it after the talk. Even more importantly, stackful coroutines come with a big, fat word of caution. While with fibers coroutines we can avoid futures and write the code exactly as blocking one, which is shown on the left, we don't really want to do it. When we compare our TX7X, using X to denote that it should not be used, to the Holy Grail code, we'll notice that there is one important thing missing from the code in TX7X. It is those re-entry markers, which are necessary to indicate points where the state of reactor can be potentially changed. This, in turn, as we discussed above, leads to a difficult to see errors and to significantly increased code maintenance costs. As a result, I do not recommend using TX7X for real-world projects. A really short real-world story in this regard. Some time ago, I was presenting the TX7X option to a billion-dollar company having several million lines of reactor code. The point was to change their current TX3 code with something more modern and palatable. Long story short, right after I presented them with TX7X, they asked me, "Hey, how we will know those points where the state can be modified? It illustrates one of the earlier raised points, that those re-entry markers on the right are really important for real-world non-blocking development. Our last take, take 8, is related to the concept which is well-known for other programming languages, such as C-sharp, but is a new kid on the block for C++. I'm speaking about await, which was recently renamed into CoAwait. As of now, it is not a part of the standard yet, but implementations are available both for MSVC and Clang. As we can see, the code in Take 8 is almost exactly the same as our Holy Grail code on the right. Even our re-entry markers have exact counterparts on the left side. Still, we have to note that at least for as of current C++ proposals, Take 8 is not 100% ideal for our purposes. Most importantly, it has problems with serializing the state of our reactor. And while the problem is not as severe as that of Take 7, it is still going to cause quite a bit of trouble. On the plus side, it might be possible to serialize our reactor with CoAwait, by as a part of serializing the whole allocator. But it is rather tricky, relies on certain properties of underlying operating systems, and as a result causes complications with such things as ASLR. From our current perspective, it is also not 100% clear whether it is really guaranteed that all the CoAwait frames will really go through our own allocator in all compilers and libraries. Now, as we are done with describing our takes, we can compare them. Most of this table should be self-explanatory, but a few things do need an additional word or two. Of course, readability is inherently subjective. There is no way around it, but it certainly exists and it's certainly very important. As for hidden state changes, it is essentially about having those re-entry markers or reasonable facsimile to denote points where the state of our reactor can suddenly change. Note that for Take 7, we cannot really enforce re-entry markers on the functions which call our RPC functions. So in case of nested calls, re-entry markers are gone. This is pretty bad, as we will need to resort on non-enforceable things such as naming conventions to denote such potential points of change. And this will lead to increase in code maintenance costs. With regards to serialization of takes 4 to take 6, it essentially hinges on serialization of lambdas. Currently, it's pretty complicated subjects, but at least there are two potential ways of doing it, which were seen to work at least in certain contexts. The first way is to have some kind of preprocessor which will replace all those lambdas back with object-oriented callbacks, which are serializable. And the second way is to serialize the whole allocator, including all the lambdas. While neither of those approaches is perfect, they seem to work, although with a fair share of trouble. For CoAwait, for serializing CoAwait, my current understanding is that it might be doable, but we have only the second option to serialize it as a part of the whole allocator. And as I already mentioned, it's quite a risky one. There are both risks related to clashes of virtual addresses when deserializing, and risk related to compiler libraries ignoring our allocators for whatever reason. Overall, I'd say that depending on specific of your project, three different approaches may happen to be viable. The first one is object-oriented callbacks. They are good, old, working for sure even in C++ 98, they have no problems with serialization. They are not exactly the most readable ones, to put it mildly, but if you want a surefire approach which will work and which will allow to serialize your state without the need to experiment, they will work at least for smaller projects, and I also seen it working for a million lines of code project too. Second option is futures. They are good if you want to stick to C++ 11. On the other hand, serialization is going to be quite a bit of headache, but it's generally solvable one way or another. The last one, CoAwait, is almost perfect for our purposes. Still, serialization is going to be even a bigger headache than for futures, while hopefully it's still doable. To summarize, while quite a few takes are usable in real world, unfortunately, none of them represents an ideal solution for our non-blocking problems, at least not yet. Now, let's discuss current C++ standard proposals and what we want from them from our non-blocking handling perspective. First, there is CoAwait, currently built as stackless coroutines. As of now, CoAwait seems to be the most likely thing to make it into the next C++ standard. And in my not so humble opinion, it's certainly the most viable proposal out there. There is still a significant issue with using current CoAwait for our purposes, and it's related to serialization. But, well, that's still the best thing we can have. The second proposal is boost-style stackful coroutines. So I know that Gore prefers to name them fibers. From our perspective with stackful coroutines, one big problem is that we hide reentry markers, that we can hide reentry markers in nested calls, which will cause quite significant increase in maintenance costs. Plus, situation with serializing stackful coroutines is even worse than for CoAwait. So rough translation, I have no idea how to serialize stackful coroutines, even if we are speaking about serializing it into exactly the same executable. The third proposal on our list is so-called resumable expressions. To be perfectly honest, I do not like this proposal for two big reasons. First, it doesn't allow to enforce reentry style markers, which is pretty similar to stackful coroutines. And second, while implementing await style logic, they are using mutexes and with devastating results too. More on it a little bit later. The last one on our list is so-called call CC, call with current continuation. I have to admit that I don't know much about call CC. That's why the gray color on the slide. But it seems to me that it's way too low level to be intuitively used in app level code. Now let's give a few pointers on what is important for our non-blocking purposes implementation-wise. As none of those proposals is carved in stone yet, and implementations are even less so, there are a few things out there which either do exist but can magically disappear from the draft, and things which we'd like to have, well, if not now, but at least in the long run. First, we do need to see those points where the state of our reactor can be suddenly changed. In this regard, I'm a very big fan of so-called suspend up and out model used by CoAwait resumable functions. Using an opportunity to speak to some members of the committee, please, please do not throw suspend up and out model away, especially on the premises such as those in P0114A0. During our discussion, we mentioned serialization quite a few times. Overall, it's a very, very important feature in the context of using deterministic properties of our reactors and message passing programs in general. In particular, practical implementation of such things as post-mortem production debugging and low latency fault tolerance do require to serialize the state of our reactor. On the other hand, it is very clear that currently, without any kind of serialization available in C++, we cannot ask to serialize lambdas or await frames. Still, there are two things we could humbly ask for. First, we want to be sure that await frames are using only heap and not stack, nothing else. It seems to be the case now, but as it's not codified, well, anything can happen. This would allow us to implement this kind of serialization we need. It will be ugly, but as a stopgap measure, it will do. In addition, when serialization is supported, using static reflection or otherwise, we want to have it supported also for lambda closures and for await frames. In particular, when static reflection is ready, please make it sure that it does cover both lambdas and await frames. Not sure whether it's feasible, but well, at least we can ask for it. Last but not least, for stackful coroutines, having current stack serialized and deserialized later, assuming it is exactly the same executable where we're deserializing it, might be of use too. Last but certainly not least, we don't want mutexes within implementations of whatever coroutines are pushed at us by the almighty committee. As practice has shown, mutexes are so difficult to deal with that even the committee members can easily leave a bad mutex-related bug in their code. To show this, let's take a look at the proposed implementation of await in P0114R0, also known as resumable expressions. As for using it, it is more or less on par with our TX7, not perfect, but more or less usable. However, the devil, as always, is in details. I would be really happy to say that implementation of await is an implementation detail, but, so we shouldn't care about it, but there is a significant problem with this specific implementation. The problem is that emulation of await in resumable expressions is mutex-based. In practice, it will mean that there is a potential context switch at each of those points. And as context switch takes at least 2,000 CPU cycles can easily go, and if we account for cache invalidation costs, can easily go up to a million CPU cycles, well, I cannot say that I like it. To make things even worse, implementation proposed in P0114R0 calls a user-defined function from under the hidden mutex. Such a practice has been observed to lead to unexplainable to user deadlocks happening once a month. It is worth noting that this problem was first described as early as in 98, when analyzing a hopelessly buggy multi-threaded STL implementation, which accidentally carried a copyright by another WG21 member. The worst case of observed behavior was what is seen in developer space as deadlock on one single recursive mutex. This is a thing which cannot possibly happen unless there is a second mutex conveniently provided by the library exactly to allow for this deadlock to happen. My educated guess is that the same problem exists for P0114R0. Necessary disclaimers. Code in P0114R0 is convoluted enough, so I might have misread it. Apologies if it's the case. Most importantly, both the problems arising from using the mutex might be fixable or not. Honestly, I don't even see why this mutex is there in the first place, but well, if there was a reason, then we may be in trouble. Fortunately, our further discussion doesn't really depend on P0114R0 being fixable. But it illustrates the all-important point of avoiding mutexes when implementing coroutines. To summarize this long and, as I see by some people leaving, probably boring talk in one single slide, we can say the following. First, we do need a way to handle non-blocking returns. And it is all about interactions with between main processing and return call processing and potential changes to the state in between. As a result, we do need a way to clearly see when the state has a potential to change. Re-entry marker or whatever replacement technology can provide. Second, Unfortunately, none of the options we have to handle non-blocking returns in C++ is perfect. Some options are outright ugly, some don't allow to see potential for state change, and some are not easily serializable. On the other hand, I am comfortable to say that as of now, core weight is certainly our best shot. It is the best we can realistically get in the foreseeable future. On the other hand, when serialization comes to standard, I certainly appreciate to, a way to serialize or statically reflect such things as lambdas and core weight frames. This concludes our very intensive talk. I hope that I was able to convey my thoughts in a digestible manner. Now we have 3 minutes left to answer some of your questions.
Hi, could you elaborate a little bit on why you see serialization as such an important priority?
Because one of the advantages of reactors is that we can make them deterministic. And to use or abuse the determinism, one of the things we want to do is to be able to serialize the state and then write, so in theory, we could serialize just all the events. But in practice, serializing all the events for a program which runs over days, it's not practical. So what we need is to have a snapshot, from time to time to have a snapshot and then write all the events so we can realistically deserialize it. Because it's just, well, otherwise the length of the all the events will be completely unmanageable.
Okay, thank you.
So I know that one of the problems with the Lambda pyramid is that it's extremely difficult to write unit tests for. Could you comment on unit testing for some of your other proposed solutions?
When we have reactors, actually it happens that the most popular and arguably the most efficient way of testing is testing at the level of events. So it is fairly rarely that we really need to go into the unit testing which goes below the level of processing individual messages. So the usual way of testing reactor is to have an engine which just throws events at your reactor and then you have all the thing reproducible because the whole thing is perfectly deterministic by definition. As for unit testing, it is done, but honestly, I didn't really see it happening in the Lambda context. You are right. It is a headache. So core weight might be the answer here, but still yet to be seen. No questions. As always, it means that either everything is clear or that nothing is clear. I hope that it is the first one. Thank you.